Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet Plush Care, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Every goal, every game, everywhere. The Times and the Sunday Times, now with goals.
Hello and welcome to the final game podcast of the regular season. The playoffs begin. No, just kidding. I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and these are sad times because it is our final podcast. Don't shed a tear just yet. Even though we've got Rory K. Smith in the studio, we also have Alison Rudd, and down the line, at least for part of this podcast, we'll have Matt Hughes, maybe even Ollie K. later, at least according to my script. Is that right, Dave?
Hopefully.
Hopefully. Coming up, we'll be chatting Louis van Gaal and Mourinho. It's not confirmed yet, but everybody seems convinced that the special one is back again. Plus, the usual quick hits, and we'll be picking out our highlight of the season. Are we going to do that? Did you just put this in the script for no reason?
Well, I did it for a reason, but I did put it in.
Did you add this?
Yeah.
Okay. But plus, we'll be picking our highlight of the season. Whee! And maybe a bit of England, too. How about that? That huge win over Turkey on Sunday. But we start with the FA Cup final. Hughesy, I'm going to begin with you. And I want to just focus on the game for now and what actually happened at Wembley. There'll be plenty of times to talk about managers in a minute. But I was skeptical about Wayne Rooney, the central midfielder. Wayne Rooney is Andrea Pirlo. I thought he was outstanding in this game. But then again, it also occurred to me that he was also outstanding because, as I saw it, Palace kind of played the 8-1-2 formation or something and just sat all the way back, and he had tons of time on the ball. I mean, did this lend any more credence that he's a viable central midfielder, or was this just an unusual game against an unusual opponent?
I think outstanding's pushing it. I thought he was very good for the sort of final quarter and then extra time. But in the first half, I thought he was fairly fitful, really, and didn't really dominate. He does great things, eye-catching things that you remember, but he doesn't dominate games from midfield in a way that midfielders need to. And I think he can play there, but only if he's got kind of two people to do the dirty work for him.
Instead of one 35-year-old man?
Yeah, quite.
I'd agree with Hughesy. I think
you guys didn't read Dicko's piece today, didn't you?
I think the first half, I think throughout, Rooney gave possession away frequently and surprisingly often. First half in particular, he seemed obsessed with playing those crossfield balls, which looked very nice but don't actually do any damage. And then I think the last sort of 15 minutes plus extra time, he looked much more purposeful. But that was actually when he moved further forward. He was essentially playing as a number 10. Rather than playing as a kind of deep line midfielder, he can play there because he's an exceptional footballer. So obviously he can play there. It's far more complicated than Rooney's got a good touch. He's got a nice sort of range of passing, so he can be a midfielder. Being a midfielder is more than that.
I got a press release from the University of Salford. Did you get it today?
No, I don't think so.
It's a really interesting press release.
University of Salford.
Yeah, they've got.
Also owned by Gary Neville and Peter Lim? Or?
Well, no,
not yet.
But you know, you'd think they'd be biased, but stats show Rooney has been underperforming for 18 months and is getting worse. So says the academics at Salford University.
Wow, there you go. Academics at Salford University, please feel free to be in touch. It's kind of irrelevant to the conversation, though, isn't it? Oh, academics of Salford University, because for the past 18...
No, it's very relevant because...
Well, he's been playing in a different position for most of the past 18 months, right?
But you're saying he was outstanding at Wembley, and you can always focus on one performance or one sector of a performance and say that was good.
Yeah, but if he's playing in
overall,
a different...
Overall, is he that good?
I think that's a really good point. That you can... that, and what Hughesy said again is right, that Rooney does a lot of wherever he plays, Rooney does things that you think, oh, that was really good. So the thing on Saturday was obviously the run for the equaliser. His run was brilliant.
Surging run.
Beat or, five
sorry,
terrible challenges.
As our chief football writer put it, the 10 seconds will be remembered as among the most important of Wayne Rooney's eventful life.
It's pushing it slightly.
I think let's see what Rooney does with the rest. Well, he's only 30. Potentially 70 years, he might be president.
I would tend to agree with Henry. I don't know. I thought he played well, and in that setting, in those games. And I'm thinking ahead to the Euros a little bit with England. If you play bad teams that will sit off you, then maybe that's not a bad thing.
So having Rooney there.
So you're
playing Rooney midfield for England, say.
I mean, if you play against Spain, then I think it's idiotic to have him in midfield. But you know,
you're playing Rooney midfield. Who do you play him in midfield with, and who's up front? How do you get Rooney into that England team?
I would presume that you could play, well, who's up front? You know, Kane, Vardy, whatever, one of those guys, right? And if you have Rooney with some sort of holding midfielder-y type?
Dyer. Rooney and Dyer?
There would be no pace whatsoever on any team of any...
Why do you need pace in your two? Sorry, why do you need pace in your two?
You need to run around and chase people. Look at N'Golo Kante all season, the player we've been raving about. Partly, he's an athlete. Eric Dyer has great additional awareness, and he passes the ball conservatively. You can't move. He's a huge unit. You need a runner in there. I think the only way... partly semantic issue, but the only way Rooney plays in midfield is if he plays at the tip of a diamond behind Kane and Bart, then he sort of drops back. I mean, I think I could see that working, but you can't play him alongside Eric Dyer. You need Dele Alli in there to have some mobility.
Tip of the diamond, again, you're talking attacking midfield, which is different 10. From what he was playing. 10, yeah. You're talking playing 10. But if you make the mobility argument, and this brings us going back to the game, Michael Carrick wasn't particularly mobile when he was young. He's very, very clever. I mean, outstanding passer. I presume he's less mobile now that he's older than Rory Smith. So if you've got two guys who, as Hughesy says, aren't particularly mobile, should Pards have exploited that maybe a little bit better somehow?
Well, he did. There was lots of running at United.
And they weren't given advantage,
so nothing came of it.
But always from very deep positions, right? They weren't trying to pull these guys out of position or tire them out or whatever, right?
It was a very conservative...
Ignored that.
Pardew approached it very conservatively. I can see why he did it, but it was very negative. And there were actually spells... I thought United were the better team throughout, but there were spells where you looked at Palace and thought, you can get at them more. I thought Bolasie, it's the second time in 4 days in cup finals we've seen a number 10 completely disappear. Bolasie was very... he was a brilliant player, but very disappointing. Zaha was fitful. Kabai didn't really influence the game at all. They looked a lot better when Puncheon came on. It did seem to be that Pardew was very happy to sit back and wait for the chance. And as Alison says, if they get the two advantages, then it worked.
All right, I'm going to talk about Pardew and the decision, the advantage not given by Clattenburg, or possibly the two advantages not given by Clattenburg, by turning to our qualified referee.
Yeah, well giving the advantage is the new black. You're supposed to do it. I don't know quite why Clattenburg didn't, except that sometimes if you see a player stumbling and you think he's gone to ground, he's on the turf, he's not going to get up, and you want to show that you've got the game under control, you might blow earlier than you should to show that you're on top of it. But he misjudged the fact that there was an advantage to be had, and the fact that it happened three times, I think, just showed, but for whatever reason, maybe he was terribly excited to have the FA Cup final, that he was whistle happy, and that was not good. It was not good at all.
Usually, the advantage isn't actually a rule, right? It's not a law of the game. The referee doesn't have to give it. It's more of a...
An interpretation,
a convention. Was this as important to the flow of the game as maybe Pards might have felt?
I can see how it feels that way if you're on the line managing your team in an FA Cup final. But equally, I can understand Clattenburg's decision. It's a long way from goal. There's no guarantee that he would actually have had a clear advantage. You know, he runs on and puts the ball in the net, but... because the opposition stopped. If the advantage is played, there's no thing to say that the course of events would have unfolded the same. So I think he's probably making a bit much of it.
But Matt, you don't have to. It isn't like he's cut out his options by allowing advantage to be played. You can allow advantage and then bring the game back. You can bring it back. And increasingly over this season, it seems that extra seconds have crept in where... You almost forget advantage has been played because the referee then does see an advantage has not unfolded and he does bring the free kick back into play. It's not like he he had to make a snap decision whether it was worth it or not. He could have just let it unfold for about 10, 15 seconds if he'd wanted to, because that's how long it can go sometimes. Well, not 15.
Yeah. And I think referees should do that more, actually. In rugby, you know, they play for about an hour and then come back to take a penalty goal. In football, that hasn't been part of the culture, really. But I think if we're going to kind of reward attacking play and penalise clinical fouls, I think you're absolutely right. I think referees should play advantage more and then bring it back to the free kick. It shouldn't be a kind of, you know, a binary equation.
I like to think that maybe he was still a little bit excited from all the pre-game joshing and joking around with Sir Alex Ferguson, you know.
But I'm not sure that's entirely appropriate for a referee. I tend to sort of be turned off by this kind of, oh, they've got to be very serious automatons who don't show any emotion, but it isn't the right...
Well, or maybe the right thing to do is, if you want to go and pal around with him, that's fine, but do it away from the cameras.
Yeah. Yeah,
I mean,
he was palling around with Steve Koppel, so it's not like you can accuse him of any bias, but it's a little bit kind of undignified.
Did Steve Koppel work for Crystal Palace?
No, but Steve Koppel was there in his capacity Crystal Palace
old
legend.
Guy.
Yeah, old yeah. guy. Yeah,
yeah.
Well, he was temporary coaching staff, wasn't he, for Palace on the day? So yeah, he was working for Crystal Palace.
He's the patron saint of Palace.
Okay, no, I just wondering. Maybe just the excitement of having met these two legends. Do you think Klatz watched the 1990 FA Cup final?
Yeah,
as a little boy.
Yeah, I thought so.
And she's like, one day I will be there. One day I will referee an FA. Do you think he wanted to become a referee when he was in 1990? Do you think that was his life's ambition?
Fascinated by the psychology of people wanting to be referees.
All right, I'm tempted to say we've had more than enough Clattenburg talk, but since Ollie Kay apparently is with us. Ollie, am I right in thinking that Clattenburg's not sort of properly English? Doesn't he have sort of some foreign roots?
The name is
no, not the name, but
sounding, isn't it? But I've never heard that.
Clattenburg.
Clattenburg. It's almost a sort of royal family type name, isn't it? But it's I've never heard that. So
all right.
you overestimate me. What a question to be asked on my introduction.
We digress. Let's talk Palace. Obviously, it's been this bizarro season. A tremendous first half of the season. Everybody going nuts about how quick they are. And look, what a great signing Cabaye is. Has he signed his contract extension yet? Or has he just talked about signing it?
Parts?
Yeah.
They said he would sign it before kickoff.
But then we didn't hear anything. Okay.
He's not signed it, but it's there to be signed. An extra 2 years, that won't be an issue.
Why does he wait? Why doesn't he just sign it if it's there to be signed? What's he trying to do?
He did say Pardew said himself he didn't want to sign anything till the season was completely over, and the club wanted to show how much they loved him and say, doesn't matter what the outcome is on Saturday, we want you to have the contract now, and he's not signed it to be true to his word, which is fair enough.
Okay,
maybe he would have wanted to sign it in the glory of success
on the pitch.
I mean, it did look suspiciously like he might have. Thought through how he would react to victory on Saturday. So, maybe he would have gone for that.
So, Palace's owners, they are Palace's part owners. I got in trouble for saying that they own the club, when in fact, like Steve Parrish and his merry band, they'll own a substantial portion, maybe even a majority. But the American owners, anyway, Blitzer and Harris, they have a more analytical approach, as a lot of these nerdy hedge fund guys do. If they look at this and they look at a team that was very good in the first half of the season and then really, really bad in the second half of the season, you might be tempted to say, the trend isn't great. Or you might be tempted to say, well, the second half of the season was just an aberration because we're all focused on the FA Cup final.
From January.
From January, yeah. Or from December, actually. I think they had a win at Stoke and then it was like nothing. But anyway, Ollie, if they came to you and said, all right, don't tell Steve we're talking to you, Ollie. Should we sack this guy? Because, you know, the weird dance, the hair, the engineering. Should we get rid of him? What would you tell him?
Certainly wouldn't sack someone on the basis that he danced.
On the basis.
It was incredibly cringeworthy, but, you know, that's...
Would you make him give you a good explanation about the incredible drop-off in performance?
Yeah, you'd want to look into that, and I'm sure he would have his reasons.
What would he say? Has anybody asked him? Why were you so good and now you're so bad?
Well, he was always trying to maintain that the drop off in league form, or spectacular collapse in league form, was slightly illusory because they were doing so well in the FA Cup and beating Premier League teams in the FA Cup. But if you look at his career, and something very similar happened at West Ham, and after a really, really good start, you know, it fell away. Newcastle, it fell away spectacularly. And it was always they blew very hot and cold at Newcastle, and obviously it's mostly cold in the final 2.5 years. But they would have these big spikes of, you know, a good month here and there. And Palace need to stay in the Premier League. You know, that's the priority. But I don't think they would be too comfortable if the bad form, bad Premier League form, continued into next season. Because to my mind at least, when he was at Newcastle, it seemed like they had a good calendar year and then a bad calendar year. And it's not terribly good, though, is it?
Okay, so you would give him a new contract. Anybody here disagree with that?
Wouldn't necessarily give him a new contract. I think that...
Well, Ollie said he would.
I don't think he did.
So, Ollie, you would not give him a new contract, but you wouldn't sack him either.
No, I don't think I would rush to give him a new contract. If there was a threat of losing him and you felt that he was somebody you would struggle to upgrade on, then look to shore it up for the medium term. But I don't think I'd be rushing to give him a new contract, and I certainly wouldn't be rushing to sack him. I think, you know, jury's out. No need to do anything.
It is curious, though. Ollie's quite right about this sort of pattern to Pardew's career, where you can look at it as like a macro trend, and it's good calendar year, bad calendar year. But you can also look, and he tends to have like six quite good games, then six really, he'll just lose six in a row, and he's done that at every club he's been at.
Was any rational? Anybody so have any? I know we're all saying this, that he's had this. We know this. Anybody have any rational explanation? Does he have any? Has anybody asked?
I think he's very patient. So they were in the middle of sort of January, February time. It was dispiriting because they'd started the season so well, and he said, "Well, I'm waiting for my sparkly players to become sparkly again." And it was like, "Well, yeah, but that isn't enough, is it? You're just waiting for someone like Bolasie to start scoring. You're just waiting for someone like Zaha to start dribbling again." Yeah, another manager might just say, okay, I'm dropping them, I'm rejigging it, or I'm changing the system. He is very patient, and I'm just offering as a possible explanation why you go through long lulls, and then he doesn't meddle with it when it's going right. So he'll go on a trajectory where it's good because he'll stick with it, but equally he won't meddle.
So he's loath to tinker.
He's conservative. Yeah,
they haven't got any goals in the team, have they? Pardew has been unable to change that. If you Conor Wickham out of Ayora as your strikers, you're going to be relying on Bolasie and Zaha, who by their nature are sort of, you know, slightly dilettante-ish.
What about Gale?
Flighty players, score goals. So that's one reason. I also think, I agree with Ollie, there's a danger that sort of the Leicester achievement and West Ham to a lesser extent has kind of skewed perceptions. I think Palace have still had a very good season, as have Watford, as have Stoke. All these teams that have survived comfortably, I think that's a success, and I disagree with the sort of Pozzo family view of football, which is if you finish the season badly, you will inevitably start the next one badly. Each 3 points is not equal. If you get points in the bag early, they're kind of worth more than in the second half of the season. It's sort of human nature when you're safe and have nothing really to play for to cope a little bit. I think that might be annoying for the fans, but that's kind of sort of inevitable. I don't think much you can do about that.
Going back to United, and just so they win a trophy, Van Gaal made a point of saying, of bringing the FA Cup with him into the press conference, pointing out that it's the first trophy they've won since Sir Alex retired, which, you know, you're kind of like, all right, so that was two managers ago, like, big deal. But when you look at this FA Cup run, I think I'm right in saying, and please feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm going from memory here, they only beat two Premier League sides along the way, other than Palace.
Everton
and West Ham. West Ham took them to a replay, and I think I'm right in saying that Everton required a last-minute goal.
Mm-hmm. That's normal, isn't it? That's normal FA Cup run. Yeah, you wouldn't. I'm sure teams have got to Wembley by beating one or two.
I think Millwall did without beating anybody.
Yeah.
It was one year. But
Palace's cup run was tougher than United's, definitely.
Yeah, it doesn't detract from the achievement.
No, it doesn't.
Well, I think it kind of does, doesn't it?
No. I think
arguably this Palace game, which they could have lost if Joel Ward's feet had been straight.
They'd not played any Premier League teams and beaten Chesterfield in the final or something, then maybe you could say, well, it doesn't really mean that much. And there's definitely something to be said for the fact that if you are a big Premier League side who plays a Football League team in the final of a cup competition, it does dampen your... But I think, no, I think if they've played three Premier League teams in, what, six games in the cup? That's half of them. That's fine.
Okay, what does it mean? No, because it's a genuine question here, right?
I think the cut run does show that United do have more character than we've given them credit for, and whether that's got anything to do with Van Gaal or not, I don't know. But I think staying in a game where you're not playing well and being able to get a late winner or do just enough, is there is something to be said for that.
Ollie, Roy said that the news of Mourinho's appointment wasn't leaked by Manchester United. I don't know what you can tell us. I presume if it wasn't leaked directly to you, then maybe you're free to speculate. If it wasn't leaked by United, who do you think it was leaked by?
Well, I don't think it came from the lips of Jose Mourinho, that's for sure. I don't think it came from the lips of George Mendes, but I got the impression it was more in that direction than the Manchester United boardroom. But I might be wrong. I mean, it was Sam Wallace wrote the piece during the game or towards the end of the game. He broke that, I think, during the press conference. Just before the Bosnich press conference.
Were you looking over his shoulder during the game to see what he was writing?
No, but he was going off whispering to people. He had the look of somebody who was going to. It had come out in Spain as well overnight that the Spanish press or some of them had said this is happening. Now I think that would suggest that perhaps more in the Mourinho Mendes Gestifut camp rather than. Rather than the Manchester United boardroom as well. But to be honest, I don't really know what can be done about that. I mean, I know people have said, it's disgraceful that Mourinho leaked this, and Mourinho hasn't leaked it.
So, Hughesy, Rory made the point, sort of lamenting the fact a little bit that, you know, the appointment of a new manager ends up overshadowing winning the FA Cup final. I want to get your thoughts on this, and can you tell me, sort of from a reporting angle, can you tell our listeners, I would imagine we all know, When somebody starts reporting the story, and of course it was reported in Spain the day before, but then in Spain I think they've been reporting every single day that, you know, Mourinho was going to be the next manager.
Of a variety of clubs as well.
Of a variety of clubs, that's right. Would you, I presume you would then try to seek confirmation from the club or from Mendes's end?
From the club, from Mourinho's end, from one of any number of third parties that are beloved of journalists or hang around football. I know for a fact United didn't confirm anything and still haven't, so I think it's a little bit bizarre that people are moaning about a leak. I think with a story like this, it's not the case of a leak. It's a case of journalists just keep asking the same people the same question, and eventually you get a kind of sniff of it. I mean, I first read the story in Ass on Saturday morning, and then Sam Wallace at the Telegraph and the BBC went strong with it immediately after the final whistle.
When you say United wouldn't confirm it, but presumably they didn't deny it either, right?
No, they wouldn't. Anything. I mean, club.
Man, we're left in mystery again. Rory, you presumably share some DNA with Hughesy, given where you're from.
Absolutely.
What was he going to say?
United in that situation will just give you a firm no comment in an official capacity. Whether there are people at the club sort of giving winks and nudges, I don't know.
Well, it would be stupid for them not to, right?
Well, I thought it was really strange when Van Gaal got off, came out of the hotel and said to the Sky Sports reporter, it's over. The club, and I was following this from afar, the club obviously made a point of saying he's not referring to his reign, he's referring to like his stay in the hotel or whatever, I don't know. And I thought that was a really weird thing for the club to do, given that inside the club they must have known that this what is going to play out today, which is that Mourinho gets the job, that Van Gaal is sacked and Mourinho gets the job. They must have known that was at least a possibility.
But financially, so, you don't confirm that, because it means he can get extra.
Oh, that's true.
Dosh.
Yeah.
Makes so it effective a sacking as opposed to a
without. I think he is going to be sacked though, rather than a mutual consent. Mutually consented.
I should point this out that we are taping this. We're taping this Monday morning in an hour and 20 minutes. United are apparently releasing a statement, so we're taking this as read that this has happened. Who knows? Maybe those wacky guys might have been leading us on. So please bear with us if that's not the case. But a lot of people had questions about the dynamic, about the leaks, about the timing, and so
one,
on.
One thing that
the only thing I would say from United's perspective, I mean, for me, were I reporting the story, if I have the confirmation from the Mendes camp and a third party, I'm okay with it. And United simply say no comment, then I'm okay with it. Mm. My guess is, and I'm purely speculating here, if United are serious, they'd kind of realize that, you know, let's all be grown-ups. We're going to say no comment on the record, but, you know, not deny the evidence at this stage. Because
there's different Chelsea masters of it. There's different types of no comment. And there's a certain art in, I wouldn't call it skill, but there's an art in reading which type of no comment you're getting. as far as I know, United didn't brief on it, which is the right thing to do from their point of view.
Can you explain to our listeners what that means?
So if you speak to somebody from a club who is in an official capacity, they will often tell you, or not often, occasionally they will tell you, no comment on the record, we're not going to make a statement about it, but they will very kindly steer you one way or the other.
So if
I go to Arsenal and say I have it in good faith that you are planning to burn down the Emirates and claim the insurance money, they will say, we're not commenting on that on the record. On background, we would suggest that would be a silly thing to write. If I went to Arsenal and said, I think you're going to sign Granit Xhaka, and they would say, no comment on it, we don't comment on transfer speculation, but on background, we wouldn't particularly have a problem with you writing that. That sort of thing is what I mean by a brief. So as far as I know, United weren't briefing on the Mourinho thing. But in this context, I think that is possibly a bit silly, because everybody knows it's going to happen, and you kind of need to try and control the news a little bit. The one thing I would say is I saw Miguel Delaney, the sort of Twitter warrior, being attacked by fans blaming the media for reporting it, as though it was the media's fault that this was happening. And you get that reaction to quite a lot of stories now, that sort of, why are you reporting this? You're making trouble. It's incomprehensible.
Who is attacking him? Wouldn't most United fans be happy that?
No, I think it's sort of a COD psychology explanation. I think it's that a lot of fans get upset if it is perceived that their club is being told it is not behaving in the right way, and so they choose to blame the media for doing it instead of the club. And you sort of think, look, the media is just our job is to report stuff. It's not our fault that United are sacking Van Gaal. It's not our fault that Van Gaal's not won enough games to get in the top four. It's not our fault they play boring football. It is just what's happening, and it's our job to report it. And I find it amazing that there are people out there who don't get that. What's really interesting about it is that for the second sacking in a row, United have handled it appallingly.
Right. I think they handled it worse with Moyes.
Do you think? I think it's tough competition.
Maybe just that Moyes is nicer. We like Moyes more. I like Moyes more.
I quite like Van Gaal.
No. Dark heart.
Can I ask a question? It's Hughie again. I'm back.
Back again.
How could they have handled it differently? You've got the most famous manager in the world publicly begging for the job, privately agitating for it. What can they do? All the running on the story has been made for Mourinho camp with information, disinformation, half-truths, and finally kind of confirmation. United, I don't think, have really done anything.
But
how can they manage that situation?
Is that not in itself quite damning, that they've been completely, in inverted commas, the biggest club in the world, are completely sort of dominated by what is essentially like a relatively small operation? As you say, it's not Mourinho briefing it. It's not Jose's not on the phone to people. It's
no.
It's all from Gestafoot.
Well, it's nice.
There's like
nice
two or three people.
For the next 2.5 years, isn't it?
I think if you look back, to an extent, it's hindsight. But if they'd made the decision, they could easily have made.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This decision in March, if the stories about the pre-contract, which are being denied, are true, then why not come out and say...
All right, the pre-contract story is beyond stupid.
Give Van Gaal the chance to say, I will be leaving at the end of this season, and Jose Mourinho is replacing me. And that way, you cut all that noise from Mourinho. Does all of the noise was because he wasn't sure he was getting the job?
That assumes that he was being sacked, whatever, which I'm not convinced is the case. I still think that if he'd have finished third or fourth, he'd have got another year. I think that there was a real dilemma. And this kind of pre-contract thing, I think it was a sort of, you know, it's a deposit on Mourinho. It's not buying the house.
And it's also the fact that, you know, Man City have been panned for doing it the other way, for announcing in January their manager will be replaced by a better manager in at the end of the season. Now, I wasn't one of those panning them for that, but I don't think it would have done much good in Man United's case, because A, the shadow of Mourinho is greater, and B, the ego of Van Gaal is far, far greater than Pellegrini.
So a much more obvious question, though, Ollie, which makes this a bit different from the Pellegrini situation. Mourinho was unemployed in January.
Mm.
Why not just sack Van Gaal right then and there, and then just end this absolute nonsense, bring Mourinho in? I'm pretty sure with Mourinho, they would be playing Champions League football next year rather than Thursday nights. You'd buy yourself time. You could evaluate the squad. You'd be going into the summer with a much better idea of what was needed. You'd have 4 or 5 months there where if Mourinho starts misbehaving, you as a club even have the leverage to bring in a director of football if that's what you choose to do. And I mean, there's a lot of things that you could have done differently. Or one other very simple thing, if you're Van Gaal, he knows he's sacked. What if he got into that press conference at the end with his FA Cup and saying, like, by the way, guess what? I don't expect to be back next year. You guys are all reporting it. Sam Wallace there has said that I'm going to be sacked tomorrow. So these are my goodbyes and whatever, and turn around that way. Would we think more highly of him if he'd done that? Would that have been a way for him to maintain a little more dignity here?
I think if he was going to do that, he wouldn't have done it in that slightly smart way. He would have done it in a perhaps slightly more... less dignified, more truculent manner that might have won whoops from some of the fans, but would not really have done wonders for his reputation worldwide.
I don't think he cares, does he?
Well, no.
Or at least get the satisfaction of putting the boot in.
But then again, he shows that he does. He shows that, you know, things have got under his skin, and it's not necessarily surprising that things have got under his skin, because he's been a sort of not dead man walking, but a man sort of walking towards the guillotine, at least for the last few months. But he's a manager who offered to resign, whether that was in a fit of pique or not. He offered to resign in December. And as you say, had Mourinho come in then, had they said, yes, let's do this, I don't think United would be in a worse position today. I think they might well have been.
No, they'd be in a better position.
Might well have got top four, and Mourinho would have a very, very clear view going into this summer of what was needed. But I think they showed a little bit too much faith in Van Gaal in December. When a guy looks like he's run out of fight, and he certainly looks like he's run out of ideas, he only seemed to really display much fight when he was in press conferences. It's great for them that they've won the FA Cup. It's nice for him. But unless they've been told by Mourinho, I don't want the job till the summer, which is possible, then I think it was a mistake to wait that long. If you're going to go down the Mourinho route, I'm not his biggest worshipper, and I think there'll be a few stronger contenders to that crown. I think he would. You know,
Mourinho had an awful lot of boxing matches and rugby matches to watch, though.
He has developed
before he took the job.
He has developed a real passion for boxing, hasn't he?
Yeah, yeah, no, look, that's not. We know Mourinho would have taken the job in January.
Oh, I don't know. He likes his rugby and his boxing.
I want to put something else in there about Van Gaal, which I don't know how I feel about this. Today's papers are, and again, Hughesy and all of you guys are going to tell us a little bit how the sausage is made here. Today's papers are full of stories and Van Gaal anecdotes, which basically make him look, you know, why the players generally, like basically all the list of bad or stupid things that Louis Van Gaal did, right? And it's and it ranges from telling Rooney to take an extra touch in the box or most strikers to long video sessions, to the story about Carrick and Rooney going to see him, to the fact that they did double training sessions on their summer tour, which, by the way, this annoys the crap out of me. This is the same
crap. I like
crap.
It when Gab says that things annoy the crap out of him.
No, no. And this was used against Capello as well. Like, ooh, they did double training sessions. And like, oh, no, their preseason training, you know, it was like, what's the term you guys love to use? It's not a holiday jolly where all the English players get drunk. It's that they're actually, like, working. It's like a boot camp type scenario, right? It's freaking preseason training, right? This is what you're supposed to do. There's nothing wrong with double training sessions in preseason training. But anyway, there's basically this compendium of stories, which are in every paper, which are all kind of the same, and all make Funhao look stupid. Now, Husey, sorry, that really uncomfortable sound, was that Husey making it, or Ollie?
No, it's probably the train announcer at Milton Keynes Central.
Okay, thank you. So, Husey, tell us, all these stories, I'm assuming you guys didn't all go and report these stories in the space of 24 hours. This is because some of them were stories that were very familiar. When all this stuff comes out, is it really a case of player agents and maybe even some people at the club or sometimes players saying like, oh, now that, you know, ding dong, the witch is dead, let me tell you all these other reasons why Funhao was bad?
Well, it's difficult for me to answer that question because I know where that story came from and obviously can't say.
Well, in general, I mean, there's lots of different stories. I'm assuming they all come from one person.
No, not necessarily, but the fact that every paper has got them suggests that there is been some element of ownership of the story. Basically, a lot of them were kind of rehashing stuff we knew already, but the killer details for me are sort of the emails and the tracking and things like that. It just illustrates to me, reading it, how Van Gaal has had lost that dressing room, to use the awful cliche, because that information can only have come from at source. Players obviously may have passed it on to intermediaries, agents, friends, whatever, family. But the ultimate source is in the dressing room.
I want to move on to Mourinho quickly. It's funny, we're giving Mourinho short shrift, but I guess we'll be talking about him a lot going forward. There's our columnist, Matthew Syed, columnist of the year. I'm just going to read his headline here. Shameless Mourinho and his clique, presumably he's referring to George Mendes.
Not much of a clique. It's just him and George.
Yeah, no. Well, and somebody else we know. Not fit to inherit the club that Busby built. And he's worried about, he refers to Mendes as loathsome, and he worries about United's reputation. Anybody, all right, none of us are United fans, as far as I know, but anybody have similar concerns? Is this a big deal? Is this purely a moral argument? Do you think United might start losing fans, or maybe some of their 659 million followers worldwide, because they're so turned off by shameless Mourinho and loathsome George?
I think Matthew's just trying to be a bit cute there, because he Matthew doesn't rate Jose Mourinho, so he's deliberately bumping up, elevating United as this pure concept that will be sullied by, tainted by Mourinho going in. There's nothing particularly special about Manchester United. Every club could make a very good case for why their club has something pure and beautiful and historic and worthy about it. And you can go on and on about the Busby Bays.
Even Milton Keynes Dons?
I was going to say MK Dons, yeah.
They too make a very good case, in fact, because of what they're trying to
right.
achieve,
no,
their
no,
work
okay,
in progress.
Okay, and enough of them.
You can. That's the point.
Yes,
that's the point.
No, I agree with you.
And I think if Mourinho was going into Glasgow Rangers, Celtic, Liverpool, probably Matthew would say the same thing.
Does he generally not? How can you not rate Mourinho? You can think he's a bit of a dick, but you can't like think he's not a good manager.
Well, you can make a case that he's a short-term manager who leaves behind in his wake a trail of destruction and immorality.
A conflict of interest.
That's massively true, but you can't say that. You can't say that. Like appointing him is like appointing a bad manager, even if it's just a short.
He doesn't. I don't think he says that Mourinho's a bad manager. He says that Mourinho is shameless and sort of unscrupulous and so on. Now, some people might have said that about United's most successful, his enemy certainly would have said that about United's most successful ever manager, right?
Well, this idea that Mourinho's antics will overshadow United. Ferguson, what, he wouldn't sell Real Madrid a virus? You always had to check under the pasta to see if the Italians had given you sauce, which even suggests that, to be honest, they're constructing the pasta incorrectly, just the sauce goes on top. Like, Ferguson wasn't like Jesus, do you know what I mean? He was a ruthless, often quite brusque and rude Scott. Like, he was not a nice bloke, Ferguson, as a manager in a professional context.
But he built a dynasty.
Ollie, how serious? I mean, I think you live probably closer to Old Trafford than any of us.
No.
No, maybe Rory does. Okay, well, you still live up north, and you've lived up north longer than Rory has.
True.
Stop shaking your head.
Not in a cumulative sense.
It doesn't really matter when you're 4 years old in Leeds or Harrogate or wherever you are. Okay, can we move on?
Yeah, but just try and be factually accurate.
Okay, Ollie's more northern than you are.
Incorrect.
More northwestern than you are.
Correct.
Okay, thank you. All right, Ollie, you've got a better pulse probably there than we do here in the London Goldfish Bowl. Is this an issue? I mean, people keep going with the story like, well, Bobby Charlton didn't want, you know, as if Bobby Charlton matters two jots to the to Woody and the Glazers. But is this an issue? Are there people who are legitimately concerned that Mourinho's not going to stick around 25 years or that George Mendes will start running the club? I mean, effectively kind of has been for the last couple of years anyway.
Yeah. Now, there are concerns about that from people I've spoken to, not at sort of senior boardroom level, certainly not in Florida. But there are concerns amongst people who have been at United a long time who think, well, yeah, you don't have to be a manager who sticks around for 25 years, because that just doesn't happen now. I mean, Guardiola signed a 3-year contract in at Manchester City. Everybody expects that to be a 3-year operation. I think what people expect is that will be approached in more of a sort of sensible, long-term legacy type of way. Whereas Mourinho, it's very much you go in there. It's there's that sort of trail of destruction, or destruction both in a positive and negative way. I'm sure there will be a trophy or two if he stays there for 3 years. There will be a trophy or two. There will be big improvement, but there will, I'm sure, be a cost to it, whether that's stopping youngsters progressing as they might otherwise have done, whether it's reputational cost in terms of the kind of fractious behaviour that he's well known for, or whether it's alienating players over time. Those are the things that happen when he stays at a club for a third season, and people say, well, it's a small sample size, it's Chelsea first time around, it's Real Madrid, and it's Chelsea second time around, because they're the only times he's got to year three. But it has happened 100% of the time, and it's been the same things happening 100% of the time. And I would say that would be a concern. That has always been my sort of question about Mourinho and United and the style, and the fact that, you know, he doesn't like expensive, creative football. He likes sort of straight lines football that right. is extremely well organised and extremely effective. But I think in an ideal world, Manchester United would be in a position where they would have given Mourinho short shrift and given him a wide berth, because like Real Madrid, they are a club which ideally would probably steer clear of somebody with those characteristics as manager. But Real Madrid were desperate in 2010, and Manchester United are utterly desperate now.
All right, we're going to move on to quick hits in a minute, but I'm going to do some foreshadowing here. After this, you will be asked what your highlight of the season was. I presume you already have one prepared.
No, my highlight of the season would undoubtedly be Leicester City, and not just any individual moment, but just the entire story and the remarkable, the way that they just saved what I think would have been one of the most disappointing Premier League seasons of all time and turned it into this remarkable, incredible story. And every time I went along to the King Power, or every time I watched them away from home, it was just a joy, because they were a breath of fresh air and an inspiration, I think, in a season where so many other clubs were a complete letdown. And look at their players, you could name any one of them, and they're all an inspiration in one way or the other. But Leicester City would undoubtedly be my highlight.
Now, I was being unkind there, mentioning Ben Elouan, one of the signings who did not work out when so many others obviously did. Ollie, thanks so much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Rory, your highlight of the season.
Can I pick a specific moment?
Whatever
can,
you
can
like.
Can I pick two specific moments?
Yes.
They're not highlights necessarily that mean anything to anybody else, but they're the
Is
two.
Is one of them the moment Matthew Syed won Columnist of the Year?
Yes. No.
For the seventh straight year?
My abiding memory of Leicester is one of those moments that I...
No, not Leicester.
No,
you
just,
can't pick
just
Leicester.
Shut up.
Okay.
One of those things that was really special was after they'd beaten Sunderland 2-0, I'd been doing the online report, I think I was there with George, and we sort of walked down the press box at the Stadium of Lights right at the top of the stand. It takes about 45 minutes to walk down, and the Leicester fans were all in the away end right up in the gods, just singing for about 10-15 minutes over and over again, "Now you're going to believe us, now you're going to believe us, now you're going to believe us, we're going to win the league." And it was that was the moment that it really sort of struck home. And my dad's a Leicester fan, and it was the moment it really struck home, and I sort of thought, Jesus Christ, they are going to win the league. And it that was a really kind of... It was one of those moments that reminds you, after a while, like in March, April, you're a bit it sounds really spoiled, but you're kind of sick of going to football matches and having your weekends taken up, and you kind of just want to be at home and like having a roast with your friends or whatever. And it was one of those moments you think that's really, it was really nice to be there. My other memory of the season also features my dad. Would you like to? I've really bonded with my dad this year.
Yeah.
In February, I wrote a piece on it for ESPN. We got invited by Coventry City's club historian to the club's Legends Day, where they...
Didn't your granddad play for Coventry City?
My granddad played for Coventry.
Gordon Smith.
Bernard Smith. All right. Gordon, come on. It was a really nice day. It was really touching to see lots of people of all ages be really kind of enthralled to meet players from the 50s and the 60s and the 70s. Ernie Hunt from of Donkey Kick fame. Dennis Mortimer, who won the European Cup with Aston Villa. What was really special to me on a personal level was... Darren Huckabee was not there, but Brian Kilcline was, who was one of my heroes as a kid. He gave a foul-mouthed speech and was wearing a waistcoat. It was really nice. But the best bit was my dad, unbeknownst to him, got asked to stand up and take a round of applause on behalf of his dad, who played for Coventry for 3 years in the 30s and helped them win the Third Division North. And my dad didn't know it was going to happen. My granddad died ages ago. And it was really touching for my dad to do that, to know that people kind of remember his dad. And he got given a tie, a Coventry City Former Players Association tie, which he now wears to all formal occasions. It's really sweet.
Oh, that's sweet. any truth that now, like, he might be persuaded, I mean, to buy the club?
My dad?
Yeah, given that Coventry have kind of... Or is that... You can't comment on that, can you?
My dad can't buy a club, even Coventry.
All right. Alison.
Oh, well, to be consistent, as I mentioned last week, if anyone's feeling low, I make them listen to the Radio Leicester commentary of Vardy's goal against Liverpool, because it might be the best commentary I've ever heard. Personal highlight? Oh, it's a bit me, this podcast, isn't it?
Self-indulgent.
Yeah. I really liked going on a steam train with the Crystal Palace team, because it was slightly surreal. I'd never been on a steam train before. On that steam train, Mile Jedinak said hi and said he'd read something I'd written about him, and thank you, which is lovely, because players just don't do that.
Is your personal highlight not James Morrison?
And equally, James Morrison remembering my name was also a personal highlight.
Can we just give a shout out?
Jurgen Klopp wearing a Beatles t-shirt.
Apart from the Jurgen Klopp wearing the Beatles, whatever. But can we just point out...
If he'd worn a Ruttles t-shirt, I would have died and gone to heaven, but he didn't. Never mind.
Not all professional footballers are egomaniacs driven simply by sex and money and fast cars.
Well, it's nice to be reminded of that.
Wonderful human beings like Mile Jedinak and...
James Morrison.
And James Morrison. There you go. And one tall one and one small one, right?
What's your highlight of the season?
Yeah.
Gabriele.
No, I mean, I don't think you can get beyond the Leicester story. I was quite struck by seeing...
Enough of Leicester already!
Exactly. Since we're all going there, what is your Leicester highlight season? I boring one, but I was struck by seeing Claudio Ranieri in tears. And more than that, I spoke to him at the Football Writers' Dinner in person. He is in complete autopilot. He's given a billion interviews since the season ended to the world's media. He has basically said the same 10 things in different order in all those interviews. I don't think the realization of what his club has achieved this season has hit him. Mm. I think it may not hit him for a while. He's still in some kind of sort of physical shock, I think, from what happened. And yeah, it is that remarkable. No matter what Cass says about like with the odds and stuff and how they weren't really 5,000 to 1 and whatever, it is the greatest achievement, season-long achievement in the history of sport, hands down. Right, how about some quick hits? And these are going to be so quick that, so for obvious reasons, we can't have Ollie join us in them. Granit Xhaka has been heavily linked to Arsenal. Aurora, you know a thing or two about Swiss footballers of Albanian / Kosovar descent. Is he the answer, old Balkan expert?
He's a very good player. He's pretty much exactly what Arsenal need, a sort of rangy, powerful, influential, tough-tackling midfielder. Really like Granit Xhaka. Think £30-35 million, which they're meant to be paying for him, is a little bit over the top, but yeah, a good signing.
England played a friendly against Turkey in Manchester yesterday, and judging from the reaction, few were particularly excited. I refer you to a piece by Matt Dickinson saying that Manchester hasn't caught Euro fever yet. Alison, what did you learn?
Probably too much. This isn't the time to learn a lot, is it? And of all the... It was dispiriting, actually, and slightly disappointing. The thing that annoyed me, worried me the most, was Joe Hart saying afterwards, we are going to try and peak against Russia, and that sums up everything that's wrong with England. They should be thinking of peaking in the final. That's what the great nations do. We should limp through the qualification. Just get through.
Like Italy.
Italy always do that. And but a good team would think big. Think big. Don't think how are we going to cope with Russia. I just found that a bit depressing.
Hibernian completed a stunning comeback to defeat Rangers in the Scottish Cup final, but matters were overshadowed by a massive pitch invasion, which reportedly saw some Rangers players and officials abused, as well as the goals themselves, which were torn down. Although it should be stressed, the majority of the invaders were apparently peaceful. Rory, you're Scottish, as I understand it.
Huh?
Is this a concern? Is this a trend? Are we making too big a deal out of this?
It is a concern, because
Rangers were very, very upset.
The Rangers were rightfully upset. I think the police took far too long to get control. I don't understand why Hibs hadn't won the Cup for 114 years. I don't understand why that your natural reaction in that situation is to try and attack fans from another club. I don't understand why Rangers fans then responded, why the Rangers fans weren't just leaving.
Wait, but according to Rangers' statement, the Rangers fans didn't respond. They showed admirable restraint.
According to quite a lot of the eyewitness accounts, that's not entirely true. You can't blame Rangers for the behaviour of some of their fans. Apparently the Billy Boy song was Sun, which is banned, complete with the sectarian lyrics. Neither club, the elements of the support of both clubs didn't cover themselves in glory. I think the police took far too long to kind of bring it under control. And what's also very concerning is that the polarisation in Scottish football is so great that nobody will accept any blame or do anything other than point fingers. And that's really problematic.
Liverpool played Sevilla in the Europa League final. That would be Monchi's Sevilla, of course. And it was a prototypical game of two halves. Alison, you were there. Is your reaction more demoralised, hopeful for the future, or angry at the Swedish referee and .com millionaire Jonas Eriksson?
I felt demoralised on the night. It rained. I missed my last train. And taxis in Switzerland are more expensive than a plane. Well, I was with the fans, and we didn't get cross with the referee because we knew that wasn't the reason. It was interesting. I'm not with the fans very often, and sadly, they did come a point where we were all right. You entertain us. You give us a reason to sing. We went very, very quiet because we could see that it was a very, very poor performance. It might be the poorest performance I've seen Liverpool give in a final. Actually, it's a weak squad taken as far as it could go this season. It's a shame there's no Champions League football to attract big names, but big names is what we need.
Gary Jacob reports in today's Times that Romelu Lukaku is open to return to Chelsea. Rory, is this something your friend Antonio Conte should be pushing for?
I don't think that's how you pronounce Romelu Lukaku in his natural accent. I think he would be Romelu Lukaku.
I would assume that it's a Congolese name.
Yes. Yeah, Romelu is his dad. Is not a name. It's his dad's initials.
All right, well,
that's where the name comes from.
Romelu, please, leave me a voicemail and pronounce your own name, please, so that then we'll just play it through next time.
He is Belgian. He would have a Belgian accent, therefore his name
would be Belgian, because he speaks one language in Belgium, right?
No, he's Francophone Belgian, so he'd be Romelu Lukaku.
All right, there you go. Romelu Lukaku.
I think that Antonio Conte would be...
that's how they speak in Puglia, where he's from.
Yeah, he'd do really well. Would have thought Lukaku might have reservations about going back to Chelsea, but he apparently would consider it.
So you read Gary's story, but should Conte say, you know what, stuff Costa, let me get Lukaku.
So Lukaku is a better long-term bet, isn't he? He's younger, less likely to...
He'd never make a director of football. He's way too indecisive.
Okay, I've got a very narrow remit question for you here, Gab, which is that it was Cup final weekend all over Europe, Spain, Germany, Italy, France. What happened in 30 seconds?
Or less. Right, here we go. Barcelona had Javier Mascherano sent off against Sevilla. They didn't play great. They were forced to defend, which was interesting. Luis Suarez got injured along the way. Ever Banega then later got sent off for Sevilla. And Barcelona eventually won, thanks also to a wonderful pass from Messi to Jordi Alba. In Germany, it finished 0-0. Mats Hummels got booed a little. Then he came off in the 80th minute. Horrible penalty sequence. Kimmich, Socrates Papastathopoulos, and Sven Bender all missing. But Pep crying at the end and lifting the cup. In Italy, Milan actually played really, 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 really well against Juventus. But they just lacked the quality. Juventus, not a good game. But in the end, they won with Alvaro Morata scoring in extra time, 1-0. And in France, Paris Saint-Germain beat Marseille 4-2. Slatan, how about that? One farewell after the other, two goals and one assist, and at the end of the game, he ascended directly into heaven.
And a toaster and a cuddly toy.
As befits Slatan. Right. That's all we've got time for today. Many, many, many thanks to my guests today, Rory K. Smith and Allison Rudd in the studio, Ollie K. and Matt Hughes on dubious phone lines from around the country. Many, many, many thanks to all the guests that we've had on this season, Tony Cascarino, James Scowcroft, George Culkin. There's many more. I probably shouldn't be naming them because undoubtedly I'll forget some, but we're very, very grateful to all of you. Many, many thanks also to our producer, Dave McGuire. He's the guy who makes it happen. He's the guy who lovingly posts the game podcast to Twitter. Many, many thanks to Max Rushton, who makes me look good by coming in to replace me. And that's why you all miss me when I'm gone. You can press that subscribe button. We won't be back next week, but there may be a few treats popping up over the summer. You'll have to wait and see. And I'm just reading from a script here. I have no idea myself what those treats are going to be, but I don't know if it's safe to reveal it yet. I mean, by this stage, of course, Funhaus sacking has been confirmed. Rory, is it true that you and Louis Funhaus will be doing a daily half-hour podcast together during the Euros?
We're doing a yoga and cycling retreat. It's going to be really exciting.
Bit of golf, too?
I don't play golf.
No, I know, but Louis does. Maybe you can caddy for him.
I don't want to do that. He disagreed with my stick selections or whatever Chad
needs to do. Stick selection. Very impressive.
The golf sticks.
Remember, you can get exclusive football highlights free as part of your subscription. It's just £12 for a 12-week trial. Just search The Times online. You'll get plenty of other great content. I know we've got a few special things lined up as well during the Euros, if I'm not mistaken, in terms of coverage. We have a great team going out there. So, yeah. Until next time, if there is a next time, bye-bye.
Your subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times now comes with access to every Barclays Premier League goal. Refresh your app, choose your team, accept notification, and you're away.
Thank you for downloading. To discover more, head to thetimes.co.uk.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.